What is the hardest thing to do? Now, of course, whenever we are posed with a question in this day and time, what do we do? Well, obviously, we go to the internet. Whenever you need an answer, you go to the internet. So I wanted to know what people thought the hardest thing to do really was. So I was able to find several lists, and from the lists I found, I culled some answers. Remaining calm, that was the hardest thing to do, remaining calm. Now, I could see that. Now, some people don't have any trouble remaining calm. They were born calm, and they will die calmly. It just, they don't get excited. Other people are way up here, they're high strung, and they're never calm. But for many, remaining calm is the hardest thing to do. And here are some others. Losing at love. Must have been a lot of young responders who lost at love. Losing a loved one. That is difficult. That's very hard. Losing a pet. Being patient. There's a good one. That's a hard thing to do. Hitting a straight tee shot. Now, if you're a non-golfer, you may not know how hard that is. Losing at anything. Losing is very hard because everybody wants to win. Oh, this is a good one. Running a marathon. Now, that's so hard, I would never even think of trying it. So I could imagine. We could all imagine that. In fact, Mayor Bloomberg was going to go on with the New York Marathon that was scheduled tomorrow. He said that very boldly, I think, on Wednesday. But I think by Thursday he changed his mind. And I think wisely so. I can't imagine inviting probably, what, over 100,000 runners or whatever, some huge number. I mean, it's incredible how many participate. And in the conditions they're facing, I think he wisely withdrew that claim and that offer. So the list is endless. I'm sure I could survey this group. You could come up with things that you think are the hardest thing for you to do or the hardest thing in general for any person to do. But today I would like to focus on one thing that most of us probably find very difficult to do. I don't know if you would rate it as the hardest thing to do for you, but you may. I'm going to leave that to you. I'm not going to take any surveys. I don't really want to know what you think about this topic. That's something for you to think about and consider as we go through the sermon this afternoon. But the one thing I have chosen that probably challenges most of us, and if it's not the hardest thing for us to do, it probably is very close to it. And that is this. Admit that we have been wrong. Admitting that we have been wrong. Now, I want you to think carefully about this because it's easy to sort of cast this off and say, well, that's no problem for me. I've never had a problem admitting I've been wrong. But, of course, I've never had the opportunity to do that because I never have been wrong. So that's why it's not very hard for me. But you probably met some people that give you the impression that they have never done anything wrong. And usually, if you find people that give you that impression, you may be smitten with the same issue yourself, as we'll see in a little vignette here that is actually a biblical story. It's an amazing way for us to find out where our weaknesses are and what we can do to discover them and change them. So how hard is it to admit that we have been wrong, that we made a mistake, that we were incorrect? You know, it's especially difficult to do if someone else is telling you that you made a mistake or that you were wrong. Somehow, if we internally can talk to ourselves about what we did wrong and admit error up here quietly between me and me, and not between me and somebody else, we can do that a little bit easier because we can hide it and still portray this invincible, omniscient, I'm always right, exterior facade that we, in many cases, want to maintain. Because it's very difficult for human nature, generally speaking, it's in your genes, whether they're Levi's or no matter what the brand, it's in the genes. It's in our human nature. It's a difficult thing for most of us to do. And it begins early. It begins early. Johnny, did you do that? Well, no. And, well, maybe I did, but Jenny did it first. And it was her idea, and I didn't want to do it. And she had my arm behind my back like this, and she told me I had to eat 3 cookies or she wouldn't talk to me for the rest of my life. That kind of thing. Well, could you just say, yes, I ate the cookies. Do you have to go through that? Can you admit it? It's very hard. It's difficult. And, of course, we can see it sometimes in our children, but at times it's difficult for us to accept the fact that it's hard for us, too. And yet, as Christians, shouldn't repentance be a big part of our lives, recognizing our weaknesses, our shortcomings, our faults, being willing to admit them, repent before God, apologize to others, accept responsibility, change the way we live, change the way we treat other people, learn from our mistakes, admit them and grow from them. Isn't that the Christian way? Isn't that what we've heard and been taught? Well, of course it is. But, you know, hearing it and then living it and doing it and accomplishing it, these are two different things. So it should be a part of our lives, this ease with which we admit our error and mistake, but oftentimes it is not. So this afternoon, let's really think about it for just a short time. Just how hard is it for us to admit that we are or were wrong? And how difficult is it for us to take correction from any source? From Garmin. From, you know who Garmin is? Have you ever met Garmin? Garmin is your electronic satellite-powered guide. Okay? The famous maker of the satellite-driven navigation devices on your dashboard. Sometimes she will tell you to do this and tell you to do that. And if you don't, then she will recalculate and tell you to do something else. And you and Garmin can have discussions, and you can call her everything but the kitchen sink, and you can shut her off because, of course, you're right and she's wrong. Well, you eventually learn not to argue with Garmin. But there are times, again, when no matter where the correction is coming from, be it Garmin, your wife, your boss, your friend, it is difficult to take, and oftentimes we do all kinds of contortions, twistings, and turnings to try to avoid accepting responsibility. We are frequently in denial about having been wrong or doing something that we shouldn't have done. We frequently justify it and explain it away and try to minimize it, etc., etc. There are all kinds of things that we do, some of them so automatic that perhaps we don't even realize we're doing them at the time. So, this afternoon, I'd like to first of all go through a few Bible examples of people who had this particular difficulty and how they dealt with it. And then I want to spend the final few minutes going over a few tips on how to take correction and how to give correction. In other words, how to take it and how to dish it out, if you can put it in the vernacular terms. That's a little bit too harsh, but you know what I mean. And oftentimes, it's much easier to dish it out. But taking it is another issue, and that's where I want the rubber to meet the road today. Let's take a look at it. How hard is it for us to admit that we were wrong? First example I want to turn to found in 2 Kings. 2 Kings, chapter 5. This is the story of Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria. It says in verse 1, he was a great and honorable man. He undoubtedly had hundreds of servants. He had lieutenants and corporals and sergeants all reporting to him. He was the commander of the powerful nation of Syria. All of the armies probably answered directly to the king. And he had leprosy. Now, for those of you that know how devastating a disease that is, you can imagine how difficult it must have been for a man of his stature and his power and authority to have such a debilitating disease, one that marked him and made it very difficult for him to have a normal life. Of course, it was very painful, disfiguring. It was constant pain, and you were basically shunned. It was a terrible disease, and it still is for those who suffer it in some less fortunate parts of our world today. He was a brave man, he was a mighty man, but he had leprosy. So the Syrians had gone out on raids, it says in verse 2, and they brought back a captive young girl from the land of Israel, and he took her in as one of his servants. And so as time went on, the little servant girl mentioned to Naaman, in some way, at least he got the message, whether it was a direct conversation or not, I don't know. But the little girl said, you know, it's too bad that my master, Naaman, could not travel to Israel, because in Israel, there's a man named Elisha, and he could heal my master of leprosy. Well, you can imagine, here's the great Syrian commander-in-chief of all the troops, the mighty, powerful Naaman. He's got this little servant girl, and she's saying there's this obscure man in Israel that could heal him of his leprosy. Well, I don't know about that. Well, as time went on, and as other methods fail, apparently it got down to the point where, well, why not? So he made the trip. And when he made the trip, he brought all of his servants and all of the gifts that he planned to give to Elisha. And undoubtedly he had chariots and horses and trailers. It was quite an entourage that came trotting up to Elisha's humble abode that afternoon or that morning, whenever. And Naaman, of course, was anticipating something. He had already thought it out in his mind. He decided what it was going to be like. And he was envisioning himself miraculously healed by this prophet of some god. So let's pick it up here in verse 9. And of course, the king of Israel was frightened to death. Because he, of course, when you see the commander of the Syrian troops marching into your country, and he's got all of this riding on whether or not Elisha is going to be able to heal him of leprosy, this could mean war, this could mean destruction, this could mean all kinds of things. So there were political ramifications as well, but we'll let that rest and talk about that another time. In verse 10, in verse 9, Naaman went with his horses and chariot, and he stood at the door of Elisha's house. And just try to envision it. This huge entourage comes up, stops, and the horses are scratching the ground, and they're snorting, and you've got all this activity out here. And here's this great commander of the troops of Syria. They're all sitting in front of Elisha's house. What happens next? Verse 10. Elisha sends a messenger out to speak to Naaman. Now, what's wrong with this picture? This is Naaman great. Naaman leader of armies. Naaman great soldier of fortune and power. I've come all this way, and Elisha doesn't even come out? Sends a servant? Well, let's see what the servant says. Go wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh shall be restored to you, and you shall be clean. Well, isn't that what Naaman came to hear? Was that the truth? Was it? Of course it was. Would it work? Of course it will. Was it God's will that that's exactly what happened? Of course it was. That didn't make any difference to Naaman. What was Naaman's first response? Remember, he had it in his mind what was going to happen, what he deserved to have as far as a welcome and a response from this humble prophet in this little negligible nation of Israel that he and his armies could overrun in a short time. It wasn't what he expected. Notice his first response, verse 11. But Naaman became furious. Boy, that's hard to believe, isn't it? Well, if you know human nature, it's not. And you think about times that you have anticipated something and it didn't work out the way you thought it would or the way you wanted it to or the way you knew it should because of who you were and what you knew. Because, you see, we really have a lot of confidence in us and what we know and what other people don't know. And usually, we believe ourselves before we believe virtually anyone else. Because we can trust ourselves and we know how smart we are. But we don't always know about these other people. And really, what do they know? We become convinced that we know and we have the answer. And Naaman was completely furious. He turned around and marched back to Syria. But in the midst of turning around, notice what he says. He said, "Indeed, I said to myself, he will surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God, wave his hand over the place and heal the leprosy. Maybe there would be thunder and lightning and dust clouds and smoke. And suddenly the leprosy would just melt away. And Naaman would be ecstatic and he would leap off of his horse and shake Elisha's hand and offer him gold and pearls and precious gifts and jewels that he had available." Which he did. He had all kinds of things available, didn't he? And Elisha's servant got a little greedy, but that's another part of the story. So he said, "Look, this is what really should have happened. This is what I thought would happen. And I'm just going home. I'm not going to mess with this. Who cares? I'll just have to live with leprosy. This isn't working." Then I'm reminded of a little verse in a children's storybook that I read to the boys years ago. "That's all right. That's all right. Boys, it really carries. Don't worry." And so here's how the little phrase goes in the storybook. The storybook phrase goes like this. "I didn't come this long, long way just to take a bath today." That's how Naaman felt. Because he goes on, he said, "Look, you know, we've got the rivers in Syria are so much clearer and so much bigger and better than that dumpy, muddy Jordan. Well, I wouldn't even stick my little toe in that river. I am out of here. This is ridiculous." Oh, he was ranting and raving. Now, can you imagine approaching him when he's in this condition after all of this? Well, one of his servants did. Bravely, I assume he came crawling just in case. Because Naaman was furious. Furious over what? Well, he was disappointed. But he was also what? He was wrong. He was wrong. He was going to be the loser. But sometimes we get so angry and so on the defensive and so unwilling to accept the fact that we don't know everything, we will punish ourselves to prove a point. Now you think about it. I'm sure we've all done it at one time or the other. Not to this extreme, undoubtedly, but it certainly in principle is something that we're all fully capable of doing. So the servant comes to Naaman and says, "Look, if he had asked you to do some great, marvelous thing, would you have done it?" "Well, I guess so. Yeah." "Well, then what have you got to lose by doing this little thing? You know, going down to the Jordan and getting yourself wet 7 times. Ah, it came back. Yeah. You see how powerful my voice is now? I was just trying to, you know, test you to see if you were listening. So, what does Naaman do? He goes down to the Jordan. Can you imagine? Here's the great Naaman. He gets off of his horse. All of this entourage is staring. He walks down to the Jordan River. He dips himself 1 time, and then he looks back and wonders, what am I doing? Look at this. I must be a ridiculous sight. I wonder how much determination and humility it took for him to dip himself 7 times. Because why 7? Is it once enough? Is it 2 enough? Is it 3 enough? Everything about that particular solution rubbed Naaman the wrong way. But to his credit, he was willing to take the advice of his servant and go down and try it. And what happened after the 7th time? Poof! It was gone. So, what's the moral? What's the lesson? Well, don't be quick to judge. Don't listen to Mr. Know-it-all up here. Because what? You don't really know it all. You and I only think we do. And we're going to see some other examples of that. And again, to Naaman's credit, he went down 7 times, came back up clean as a whistle on 7, but still had leprosy on 6. So God sometimes puts us to the test and in ways that we aren't aware of, and this is quite an interesting story. And he returned, of course, and gave glory to God and thanks to Elisha. Elisha turned down the gifts, but his servant had some other thoughts, as I said. Let's try another example in 1 Kings 22. 1 Kings 22. This, oddly enough, involves Syria again. There had been a lull in the war between Israel and Syria, and Ahab wanted to crank it up again. He wanted to attack Ramoth-Gilead. He knew he couldn't do it himself, but so he went to Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, and he wanted to form a military alliance with Jehoshaphat and attack Ramoth-Gilead, or Syria. And so he scheduled a rally of sorts. He invited Jehoshaphat and his court, and he brought his court and his officials and his prophets and all of their regalia out into some space, out into the countryside, let's say. Each king, the king of Israel, Ahab, and the king of Judah, Jehoshaphat, had kind of a mock throne. And as they sat on these thrones, the wise men and the prophets and the people in general were really trying to encourage a yes vote on going to war and a yes vote from Jehoshaphat to align himself with Ahab. So it was a rally. It was a rah-rah session. And Ahab was driving it, and Jehoshaphat was basically getting into the spirit of things. And Jehoshaphat said, yes, your horses are my horses, your chariots are my chariots. And it really looked like things were going Ahab's way. And all of Ahab's prophets said, yes, go up, you will conquer, you will be victorious. Everybody was celebrating. But suddenly Jehoshaphat paused and said, man, you know, before we do this, maybe we should ask a prophet of God what they think about it. Now, it tells you that Jehoshaphat knew there wasn't a prophet of God around that yay, rah, rah rally that day. And Ahab knew it too. In fact, he did invite the prophet of God because he knew what the prophet of God would say. He didn't want that advice. He only wanted advice that agreed with him. Have you ever been guilty of that? You selectively ask people for advice that would agree with you. You know, I took a survey and 100% of the people I talked to thought it was a great idea to buy that boat or whatever your decision is. When in reality, you probably didn't ask an objective cross-section of people, and you probably stayed away from certain individuals that you felt would not give you the kind of advice you wanted. What is the kind of advice we usually want? The kind of advice that what? Supports our opinion. The decision we've already made. That's the kind of advice we want. We don't like contrary advice. It's hard for us to take, isn't it? In many cases, it is. You have to speak for yourself. So here we go. As I said in verse 5, Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, "Please inquire for the word of the Lord today." Well, notice verse 6. Then the king of Israel gathered the prophets together, about 400 men, and said to them, "Shall I go against Ramoth-Gilead to fight, or shall I refrain?" So these are Ahab's prophets. These aren't the prophets of God. These are his paid wise men. And you can get the kind of wisdom you want if you pay for it. And of course, what did the paid wise men say? "Go up, for the Lord will deliver it into your hand." Well, here's Jehoshaphat coming back. "You know, Ahab, are you sure there isn't a prophet of God that we could inquire of?" Well, the king finally admitted it. Notice, there is still one man. There was one man left in the entire nation of Israel that he knew was a prophet of God. "There is one man, Micaiah, the son of Imlah, by whom we may inquire of the Lord." Now, check out this next verse or phrase. "But I hate him." I hate him. You know, he never has anything good to say about me. I don't care what God says. That prophet never has anything good. What does that translate into? He never agrees with me. He never has anything good to say about all my ideas. So, if you know anything about Ahab, remember, he never had a lot of good ideas. In fact, he was usually on the wrong side of the issue. Not to mention where his wife was, the lovely Jezebel. So, Ahab didn't want to call upon a prophet of the Lord because he knew that the prophet would tell the truth and he didn't want to hear the truth. So he was selective. And of course, he knew he was wrong, but he wanted to go to war and he didn't want the truth to stop him. And Jehoshaphat was embarrassed when he heard that. "Well, don't say that, Ahab. Don't say that. I mean, this is a prophet of God. You shouldn't hate God's prophet." "Well, why not? He doesn't agree with me." Well, finally, the king did call and ask Micaiah to be brought to this big rally. So before Micaiah could come before the two kings, the other prophets got a hold of him and said, "Look, Micaiah, we've all stuck our necks out. We've all said go to war. So if you want to throw in with us and you want to keep peace and keep everything on a really even keel here, you're going to agree with us." Well, of course, Micaiah wasn't going to go for that. And it's interesting to see how it unfolds. Because Micaiah comes up and Ahab asks the magic question, "Micaiah, you know, what do you say? Should we go up? Should we attack Ramoth-Gilead?" Well, in verse 15, here's what his answer is. "Go and prosper, for the Lord will deliver it into the hand of the king." Well, that must have been a great relief to Ahab. Well, not really, because notice what he says. Verse 16. The king said to him, "How many times shall I make you swear that you tell me nothing but the truth in the name of the Eternal?" He knew Micaiah was fibbing. He knew Micaiah was pulling his leg, wasn't telling him the truth. This undoubtedly had happened before, or else why would Ahab say, "Look, Micaiah, how many times do I have to tell you? You tell me the truth the first time." And he knew it was going to be contrary. And so Micaiah did tell him the truth. "You go up, you're going to die." Well, the other prophets disagreed, and there was an argument, etc., etc. Well, he did go up, and he did die. But the point is, he had made his decision. He was right, And he was not going to listen to anybody else. He was not going to take that correction. He was not going to admit his error. He would rather die in battle. He would rather go down to his grave than admit his error. Pretty sad, isn't it? And yet, sometimes we can get into a similar situation if we're not careful. 2 Samuel chapter 12. 2 Samuel chapter 12. This is the confrontation between Nathan, the prophet, and David. Now, of course, we know the story behind this. It's very easy to set it up. David lusted after Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah. He took her. He arranged for the murder of Uriah. And after an appropriate time of the widow's mourning, she trotted over the castle, became part of David's harem, one of his wives, and they were going to live happily ever after. And she was pregnant with a little one, and everything seemed to be going swimmingly well. And you think about everything that David winked at himself. The lies he told, the murder he committed, the multiple compromises with God's laws, His principles, His commandments, His way of life. Everything about it was absolutely disgusting and revolting. Could David see it? No. What did he say to Joab when Joab came back and gave him the news of Uriah's death? Do you remember what he said? Ooh, that's the way it goes in battle. You win some and you lose some. Well, how did Uriah die? He died because David sent a note in Uriah's hand to Joab, telling Joab to put Uriah in the front lines and then pull back when he's at the wall so that he would be an easy target for the marksmen on the wall with their bows and arrows. And Uriah died, just as David hoped he would, just as David directed that he would. And then basically tried to comfort Joab by saying, you did all you could, that's just the result of war. And he went on with his life as though nothing had happened. And he had a new wife. She was expecting a son. Everything seemed to be okay. And he couldn't see. He couldn't see. He was blinded. He was so desirous of Bathsheba that he compromised many, many things. And, of course, it cost him and his family for generations, didn't it? It was a curse that kept cursing. It was a very, very sad time in the life of David and his entire family. But here we have God confronting David through Nathan the prophet. Now, you all know the story. Nathan comes before David and has a parable. And he describes a rich, wealthy man who has guests coming to his home for dinner. And the wealthy man lives next to a poor man who had a little pet lamb he and his family had raised. And he wanted something to feed his guests, so he went over and took the poor family's little pet lamb, slaughtered it, and fed it to his guests. Disgusting, said David. When Nathan asked, what would you think, David? What should be done to this man? And David took it hook, line, sinker, boat, motor, pickup, everything. And said what? Verse 5. So David's anger was greatly aroused against the man. And he said to Nathan, as the Lord lives, took a vow, as the Lord lives, the man who has done this shall surely die. And not only that, he shall restore fourfold for the lamb because he did this thing and because he had no pity. Do you see how insightful and precise he was in analyzing the evil perpetrated by the rich man who killed the lamb? How could he see that other person's sin and identify it as disgusting and revolting, in fact, deserving of death. And then, over here in his life, couldn't see a thing. Everything was fine. How could that be? Well, it should teach us a lesson. Once again, admitting that we're wrong is usually accompanied by an overwhelming belief that we are right. That's why it's so hard for us to admit that we are wrong. And our minds, coupled with, you know, our human nature, can compromise and do things that we know aren't just exactly right, but somehow we can justify it. We've all done it. And David did it in spades here. However, when Nathan said in verse 7 to David, "You are the man," and then he went on to describe everything that David had done. And I want you to notice that at the end of that description, in verse 13, what did David say? "Well, I can't believe you're accusing me of that. Nathan, I did no such thing. Uriah died in battle, and I just married a widow, and I went on with life. That was never my intent." No. What do we usually do if we are guilty and we have someone who's confronting us with our guilt or our responsibility? Do we often try to minimize what we did? Do we often try to give disclaimers or say, "Well, it wasn't really that way, and I didn't really mean to do that, and it wasn't my idea," sort of like the cookie thing I mentioned earlier. You know, I wonder if this aspect of David's character is what got him the label of being a man after God's own heart. Because when he recognized his sin and his error, he immediately embraced it and admitted it. There were no disclaimers. There was no justification. He admitted it. And he was repentant. And I wonder if that's why God called him a man after his own heart. So you see, even David got caught up in believing what he was doing was right. But at the same time, he could identify those wrongs in the life of this man in the parable. So it reminds you of this old saying, you know, you point a finger at someone and there are three pointing back at you. Oftentimes, the weakness or deficiency that you recognize in someone else is what? The one you have. That's why you're intimately familiar with it, and you can identify it in somebody else. But for some reason, it's not readily noticeable to you or to me. And when someone else brings it up, we're offended. And we draw the drawbridge up, we release the crocodiles, and get the hot oil ready because they're attacking us. It's like Ahab said of Micaiah, "I hate him. He never has anything good to say about me." Well, in some cases, we need to hear what's bad about us and what we did. And we need to have the kind of attitude that David expressed here. And you go on in the account. David fasted for 7 days, remember? Pleading with God to spare the life of the child. On the 7th day, what happened? The child died. His servants were fearful of even mentioning the death to David, for they knew how he had sorrowed and fasted and mourned and prayed for God's intervention fervently for 7 days. They thought, "What will he do now? Will he commit suicide? Will he go over the deep end here?" That's why they were so shocked when, after David overheard them talking about the child's death, he simply asked them, "Is the child dead?" They said, "Yes, he is." He rose up. He bathed. He got something to eat. He went to worship. In other words, he went back to normal. His servants were shocked. How could he do that? How could he flip the switch like that? And they finally couldn't stand it. They asked him. And here's his explanation. Verse 22, "While the child was alive, I fasted and wept, for I said, 'Who can tell whether the Lord will be gracious to me that the child may live?'" So he wasn't blaming God He was asking and pleading for God's grace, mercy. But God exacted that penalty. And David knew that it was just and correct. Verse 23, "But now he, the child, is dead. Why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? God has spoken. I accept it and I go on with my life." There's another tremendous trait and quality of David that we could emulate. He was truly repentant. When he recognized his sin, he didn't hold God responsible. He wasn't bitter. He went on with his life. Tremendous lessons in that account. Let's turn to another in Numbers 22. This is perhaps one of the most humorous accounts in all the Bible. At least, IMO, acronym for, in my opinion. Numbers 22. The story of Balaam and his donkey. Numbers 22. Now, Balaam is an interesting study in and of himself. I don't want to get into too much background, but Balaam knew an opportunity when he saw it. And he was interested in getting some remuneration for his ability to prophesy the future. And he just wanted to go over and talk to certain individuals. He kept begging God. God didn't want him to go. But God was really quite disappointed in Balaam's attitude. And Balaam's heart was not right. He was just an independent renegade. And it gets him into big trouble. And in this account, it really illustrates this thing of convincing yourself that you're right and what you want is right. And you put blinders on and eventually you can become completely blind to what you're doing and where you're going, because what you want is so important to you. And your opinion and your decision and your evaluation of the situation is absolutely right. Whether God thinks so or not is irrelevant. I'm right. And I'm going forward. This is the attitude of Balaam. I know I'm right and I'm going forward. The thing is, you don't always know the whole picture. You can't always see the big picture. And that's what Balaam found out. Let's read this account and see if we can't draw some lessons from it. So essentially, Balaam kept begging God, "Let me go, let me go, let me go." God grudgingly finally let him go to talk to the people, and he was supposed to curse the enemies of Israel. But nonetheless, let's begin here in verse 22. Balaam did several things along the way to frustrate God, and in verse 22, God's anger was aroused because Balaam went. Not just that he went, it's with the attitude and the motive that he went with. "And the angel of the Lord took his stand in the way as an adversary against him." So God sends an angel to block Balaam's way and to cause him to give it a second thought, because God was not pleased with the direction this thing was going. But Balaam had made his decision and he wasn't going to admit anything. He was going to keep pressing. So an angel with a flaming sword shows up on the scene. Balaam is riding his donkey. I'm grateful for the New King James wording. And his two servants were with him. So this must have been quite an entourage again. Here's mighty Balaam riding the donkey, two servants probably walking on each side. Suddenly, the donkey sees the angel standing in the way with his sword drawn in his hand, and as any smart donkey would do, he turned aside out of the way and went into the field. But there was another donkey there that wasn't very smart. That was Balaam. Balaam took his rod out, struck the donkey, and drove her back onto the road. Now, follow the metaphor, because there are times when you have people and circumstances, and in this case, even a dumb animal, who suddenly talks, by the way, trying to convince you to do otherwise, but you are so determined, and you know you're right. And you will not admit that you're wrong. It's too humiliating. It's too embarrassing. It's never happened before. You can't bear the humiliation. Whatever. Continuing. So the donkey's back on the road. Then the angel of the Lord stood on a narrow path between the vineyards, with a wall on this side and a wall on that side. Well, it's becoming more restrained now, the path. See, first it was broad, and the donkey could run out into the field to avoid the angel. Now, the angel's right between those two walls, and the donkey and Balaam are bearing down on the angel. What does the donkey do? The donkey veers off to the side and crushes Balaam's ankle against one of the walls. Oh, that was real popular with Balaam. So he's pulling his staff out again and beating the donkey. You know, sometimes, again, hearken back to the story of Ahab. He didn't like Micaiah. He just hates me. So it's the same principle. The donkey is advising me not to go where I'm going. I'm going. I am going. Come Gehenna or high water, I'm going. So now, finally, what happens? Well, the angel of the Lord went further and stood in a narrow place where there was no way to turn, either to the right or to the left. Well, this is going to be it. Now, Balaam is going to stop. He's going to reconsider. He's going to admit that he's wrong. No, he's not going to. Notice what happens. When the donkey saw the angel of the Lord and there was no place to go, what did the donkey do? Just dropped right down. Gave out completely, down on the ground. And, of course, Balaam is just beside himself with anger. Verse 27. He struck the donkey with his staff, and I'm sure he just kept beating that donkey and beating that donkey. Because, after all, he's right. And he knows everything. He knew exactly what he was doing. He knew that God had, quote, given him permission, unquote. And he was going to do exactly what he wanted to do, and nobody was going to deter him. Nobody was going to tell him that he couldn't do this thing because he was Balaam. Well, here we go. The Lord then opened the mouth of the donkey. I mean, how completely self-confident and self-absorbed do you have to be to refuse everybody else's advice and even the advice of a talking donkey? You have to be pretty determined. I've never had an animal talk to me. I hope it never happens. If it's God's will, I'll listen. But you see the desperate measures that God had to take to get Balaam to listen? Sometimes God tries to get us to listen, too. You know, it's the wide field that was the first warning. Then it's the narrow passage, the second warning. And then there's no way out, the third warning. Sometimes we just want to plow through because, what? We know we're right, and it's too painful to admit that we've been wrong. So Balaam is addressed by the donkey. The donkey says, "What have I done to you that you have struck me these three times?" Balaam was so self-absorbed by this whole thing that apparently he did not even recognize the unusual nature of a talking donkey, because he simply responded as though it were as normal a thing to do as anything. He said to the donkey, "Why, because you've abused me. Listen, I'm the aggrieved one here. I'm the one that has been mistreated, not you." That's, again, our human nature. We just can't admit. You didn't beat the donkey? Well, no, you abused me. That was the only thing I could do, is pick up my staff and beat you. Well, ridiculous, but that's Naaman's reasoning. That's human nature. Or Balaam's, excuse me. Because you have abused me, I wish there was a sword in my hand, for now I would kill you. Well, isn't that stupid? I mean, if he was thinking, he would have said, no, I could make money with this talking dog. I mean, think of it. No, he was ready. He was ready to kill the donkey. And all the donkey was trying to do was save his life. And of course, God was trying to change the course of his action and his journey through the donkey. And God himself had tried to talk to him as well. The whole thing shows how Balaam was just hard-nosed and determined and would not admit his error. So the donkey said to Balaam, after the donkey's life was threatened, am I not your donkey on which you have ridden ever since I became yours to this day? Was I ever disposed to do this to you? You know, I've been faithful to you ever since you got me. Would I do something to hurt you or harm you? Have I ever done that? Balaam says, well, he thought about it and he said no. He's still carrying. He is so absorbed he can't even recognize the supernatural nature of this conversation, because he's still going to be right. Then the Lord opened Balaam's eyes, and he saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way with his drawn sword in his hand, and he bowed his head and fell flat on his face. Then he saw what the donkey saw, and boom, he was down. But until he saw what the donkey saw, he was not going to change anything. And God opened his eyes. In God's mercy, he opened his eyes. And note what the angel of the Lord told Balaam. Why have you struck your donkey these three times? You know, you probably should have struck yourself. Behold, I have come out to stand against you because your way is perverse before me. The donkey saw me and turned aside from me. If she had not turned aside from me, surely I would have also killed you by now and let the donkey live. So who really was the donkey? And sometimes we fulfill that same role because we find it so difficult to stop what we're doing and admit that we shouldn't be doing it. I hope it's not that hard for us to admit that we have to be brought to the point that one of our pets has to talk to us and remind us that we're making a mistake. That would get my attention, probably yours too. But if you're determined, as was Balaam here, it didn't seem to cut it until he could actually see what lie ahead for him. And sometimes we become so inward we cannot see, and we refuse to recognize what others see. We can't see it. And if we can't see it, it isn't real to us, and we're going to continue to do what we think is right because we cannot admit our error. I have one more quick example to relay here in Matthew 14. Matthew 14. If you recall, Herod, verse 3, this is relating the historical account of John the Baptist being arrested. Herod arrested John and bound him up and threw him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, because John had told Herod that it was unlawful for him to marry his brother Philip's wife. So rather than admit his error, what did Herod do? Well, I'll have John thrown in prison. And sometimes when people try to advise us contrary to our will, we throw them in prison. We isolate them. We turn our backs on them, much the same as Ahab did to Micaiah, because, well, they hate me, they don't like me, they never agree with me, and how could they not? I'm right. I'm right. Admitting we're wrong, very difficult. And if we have power like Herod, Oftentimes, it's even more difficult to admit because people don't expect people in power to make mistakes. But, of course, repentance and humility are all very much a part of our Christian character, and sometimes this tendency, this very hard thing to do, admitting that we've been wrong, can complicate our Christian lives and not make them easier. Now, just a few points on taking correction, and then a few on giving correction, and we'll conclude this afternoon. First of all, on taking correction, in most cases, try to disregard your initial response. If someone comes to you and has something of concern to relay to you and mentions something that they believe you may have been mistaken about or did something wrong or inappropriate, it would be good for you to generally disregard your initial response because it is usually what? Negative, emotionally charged, critical of your accuser or your enemy, quote unquote, angry, unbalanced, and inappropriate. And yet so often we let our emotions carry us away and we return fire because we think we're being fired upon when in reality someone is trying to help us. In fact, who knows, it may be God using someone else to correct us and refine us as gold refined in the fire. But oftentimes we are so resistant and so reluctant that we won't even entertain the possibility. Which is my second point, take time to think before you speak. Ask yourself some probing questions. Is this correct? Was I wrong? Am I wrong? Do I need to apologize? Do I need to change something? Does this person have a valid concern and a valid point? But it's so easy to lose all of that objectivity in the flare-ups of anger and frustration and resentment that tend to well up when we feel that we are accused unjustly. I mean, count on your single finger the number of times that you felt you've been accused justly. I mean, how often does that happen? As opposed to your thinking you've been accused unjustly. Well, I think the scales, you know, really tip in favor of, well, I was accused unjustly here and unjustly there. Where does that take you as far as really introspectively changing your life, which is the gold that God wants to refine, and Satan would like to stir up all this other stuff to make us oblivious to what God is trying to do, just as he did with Balaam. Another point, don't resent the messenger. Examine the message. Don't let the messenger throw you off. Ask yourself what you can learn from this experience. Try to knock down all of those self-imposed barriers to admitting your error and analyze it from an objective standpoint. And learn to sincerely apologize, accept responsibility, empathize and sympathize with those who have brought this to your attention. Thank them. Don't deride them and dismiss them. Now, there may be some cases when it was uncalled for, inappropriate, and then you have a chance to explain what really happened and come to closure and agreement, but all too often, we immediately put up the defenses and we're not able to cope with and deal with the admission of error or mistake or a wrong opinion or a wrong idea. And many times we assume things are truth when they are in fact not. Now, as far as giving correction, it's very difficult to do. I dare say that none of us really enjoy being corrected. Ask your children. They don't. None of us enjoy it. We'd rather be congratulated, right? We'd rather be encouraged. We don't want to be corrected. So realize that everybody else feels the same way. So if you feel compelled to correct someone, you've got to make sure that you make a deposit in their emotional bank account that lets them know that you really do care about them. It can't be the only thing you say to them in 3 years. You know, I think you made a huge mistake by doing this or that. Well, you don't have anything built up in the positive ledger of their emotional account with you to justify that huge withdrawal, because when you do make a statement like that, you make an emotional withdrawal from that person. And they are angry and offended and upset. Well, how dare you? And suddenly it all explodes. That's why we don't go to our brother. That's why we don't offer correction. That's why we tend to ignore it and keep it to ourselves. Or worse yet, talk about the situation to others. Everybody else except the person. That's called gossip or rumoring. So it's all very complex and it's all very challenging. We're the only ones we can control in this situation. So make sure that if you do approach someone, that the issue at hand is serious enough to approach the individual about. Make sure you have accurate information. And when you do speak to them, make sure you speak the truth in love. What if they lied about something? Well, no problem. You just walk up and tell them they're a liar. Simple as that. Why do I need to... What do you mean speak the truth in love? I just spoke the truth. You're a liar. And walk away. Is that speaking the truth in love? Well, it might be speaking the truth, but it's not speaking the truth in love. How hard would it be to tell someone they're a liar? Well, that's a pretty serious accusation. To say that someone is a liar implies that that's all they do. It's like, what do you do for a living? Oh, I'm a roofer. Oh, well then what do you do morally and ethically? I'm a liar. No, it's not the same, you see. Someone may have stretched the truth. Someone may have repeated something that wasn't true. Yes, it may have technically been a lie, but does that make the person a, quote, liar as far as their avocation morally? In most cases, no. Not at all. So all of this has to be considered. When you speak the truth in love, you attain that spiritual balance that only God's Spirit can give you. And of course, the old "do unto others as you would have them do unto you" comes to mind as well. Approach them the way you would like to be approached. Well, I just want the truth. Well, remember, speak the truth in love. That's the best option imaginable. And expect some pushback. Some pushback. Don't think that any more than you would. Oh, yeah, you're right. Okay. Sometimes it's like David. And yes, you're right. I was wrong. Other times there's some repositioning. There's some countercharges. There are all kinds of things that go on. But my point this afternoon is this. If admitting that we are wrong is the hardest thing for us to do, let's consider what we have heard and studied today, and then ask God to correct us in His mercy with compassion and love for us in doses that we can absorb and from sources we can respect and accept. Even donkeys. Even donkeys. So let's make correction a growth opportunity. And let's make admitting that we were wrong an easier thing to do.